we're going to stay within that book the entire lesson tonight, the book of Esther. So good being with you again this evening as we come to a close of another day. So good being with a congregation that has the spiritual leadership that you have here and how they are concerned about the well-being of this congregation and make sure that things are done decently in order and harmony with God's will. So it's exciting to me. Perhaps you've heard of a Jewish feast named Purim. The Feast of Purim is a Jewish feast that came to being during the time of Esther. And we're going to see how that feast came about by the end of our lesson this evening. I like the book of Esther because the book of Esther gives you confidence, understanding that God is still in control. Now, when we go to chapter 1 of the book of Esther, the time period of the book of Esther is approximately between 486 and 465 B.C. And, of course, when you look at that, we have what I consider four main characters in the book of Esther. Now, I wish they were named Joe, Jim, Kathy, but that's not how they're named. The first is King Ahasuerus. And I don't know if that's, I'm going to just be bold, Ahasuerus. Some of you might know him as King Xerxes. He's the king at the time of the book of Esther. Then we also have Esther, who was also known as Hadassah, but we know her as Esther. Then we have Mordecai, and then we have the character Haman. And it's interesting, you read the book of Esther, if you just can't put it down. Once you start reading it, you have to read the next chapter and the next chapter and the next chapter. And before you know, you're done with the book of Esther. But in my study, these are the main characters within the book of Esther. And we find it during the Medo-Persian. Now, I've come to the conclusion in my study of the book of Esther, you may differ than me, but in my study of the book of Esther, you have God's providence. And what's interesting in the book of Esther, you have God's providence, but you don't have God's name mentioned once, not one time in the book of Esther, but you have God's providence. You have the confidence of Mordecai, and you have the courage of Esther. And we could go back to the queen before, Vashti. You have to give her a compliment that she was willing to stand against what the king wanted her to do, but she's not a main character in this book. Those are the ones as we looked at there. So providence, confidence, and courage. That's what we have in Esther. So let's go to chapter 1. Esther chapter 1. Breaking down Esther chapter 1, we have the reaction to the disobedient queen. Now we have the king who is, I would say, he's kind of like a party animal. He likes to have a lot of social gatherings. He likes to have a lot of alcohol. He likes to pump himself up and just be that good old guy as he's the king now of the Medo-Persians. And if you look with me in Esther chapter 1 and verses 3 through 5, Esther chapter 1, verse 3 through 5, it says that in the third year of his reign, he made a feast for all his officials and servants, the powers of Persia and Media, the nobles, the princes of the provinces being before them. And when he had showed the riches of his glorious kingdom, you got to say, he's not shy to say who he was, and the splendor of his excellent majesty for many days, 180 days in all. And when these days were come completed, the king made a feast lasting 7 days for all the people who were present in Shushan, the citadel of the great, from great to small, and the court of the garden of the king's palace. So there we have the beginning in verses 3 through 5. He's having this great feast. He has this seven-day party, so to speak, this afterwards. And look at verse 9. And verse 9, or as we go 3 through 5, he wants the queen to come before him. It says, Queen Vashti made a feast for the women in the royal palace, which belonged to King Ahasuerus. And we find in verse 10, on the seventh day of this feasting, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman Bethahaber and Bigtha. See all these names. I should have somebody read those for me. And Abitha, and called these seven eunuchs, and he the seven eunuchs of the king. Now think of this. I want you to visualize whether you can say their names or not, or whether you're going to tell me I didn't say the names right. That's fine. But he had these seven eunuchs from himself go to the queen. And the reason he had these seven eunuchs go to the queen, he wanted to bring the queen, verse 11, bring Queen Vashti before the king, wearing her royal crown in order to show her beauty to the people and officials, for she was beautiful to behold. Now, there's questions there as to what extent did he want to show her beauty. Some will go to this extreme to say he wanted to show her beauty that she had possibly hardly nothing or nothing on. I don't know if that's true. But in other words, he wanted to show the queen's beauty to this drunken mob for 7 days and parade her before the others. And we find now, remember, he sent seven eunuchs to go get her. So this is an important thing to him. Goes on in verse 12, but Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command and brought by his eunuchs. Therefore, the king was furious. Think about it. This king is self-absorbed. He likes to show the power he has, because he had great power at that time. He likes to show the wealth that he has, and he likes to show his beautiful wife that he has. And she says no. Oh, my. That presented a problem. And you go in the bottom of chapter 1, verses 19 through 21. It's brought to the king's attention that if you just let this pass by, I'm paraphrasing now, if you just let this pass by, you have given cause for yourself and all those rulers to be disdained because she refused your authority. So long story short, as you read verses 19 and 21, she's deposed from being a queen. She could have been put to death, but she wasn't, to my knowledge. But she is taken out of her place of authority. She is no longer the queen. That establishes the book of Esther. It's the time of the Medo-Persians. You have this king who is self-absorbed, who is rich, who likes to have these parties, who likes to promote himself, and he's been challenged. That's the beginning of the book of Esther. And then we come, as we come to chapter 2, we learn about Mordecai and Esther. If you go to chapter 2 and verse 7, it says, and Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman was lovely and beautiful, and when her father and mother had died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So this little child was orphaned, and Mordecai took her as his own daughter, and he raised her. And we're not reading all the verses, but in this time, he informed Esther not to reveal to others that she was a Jew. You're going to see how this all plays out as we study the book of Esther. As we go on, in verse 17, chapter 2, verse 17, it says, the king loved Esther more than all the other women and obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set a royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Now, it's interesting. If you don't take time to think about what's happening, it almost thinks that, okay, chapter 1 closed, and immediately after he deposed Vashti, he brought an Esther. No, that's not exactly what happened. How I know that is because we learn in chapter 1 in verse 3, the story of Esther. Go back to chapter 1 and verse 3. The story of Esther begins in his third year of his reign. So 1-3, it gives a time frame, the third year of the king's reign. When we come to Esther being queen in 2:17, if you go back to one verse, to verse 16, it's now in the seventh year of his reign. Did you catch that? So again, you had the third year of his reign, chapter 1. Before she becomes queen, you have the seventh year of his reign. So there's a time span that goes by before another queen is installed. Also, if you read chapter 2 in its entirety, if you go back to verse 12, all these women that were preparing to be the possible queen for this king, they had a year of preparation. So within that time span, you had a year of preparation of her that if she was chosen, she would be queen. I just point that out because sometimes we read that and we think it happens just immediately. Bing, bing, bing. Well, you had some years transpire here on this. But nevertheless, she becomes queen. Now, it's interesting in chapter 2, and I want to bring this out. I truly believe in God's providence. I can't say when there is God's providence, but God's providence is still working to this day. Just because he no longer chooses to work by miracles doesn't mean he doesn't choose to work. He can work by his providence, as he does in this book, where there's no miracles involved, and I believe God's hand is in all of this. As we continue in chapter 2, back to down to verses 21 through 23, Mordecai, verse 21, we're not going to read all these verses, finds out that two of the king's eunuchs are plotting to kill him. Verses 21 through 23 of chapter 2. So what Mordecai is, he filters through Esther about this plan to kill the king. And those two men are found out, and they're put to death. Okay, so here this plot. Nobody thinks nothing of that. Wait how it comes together in the whole picture. And then we move on into chapter 3. In chapter 3, we come into contact with Haman. Haman is an arrogant individual that simply hates the Jews. He despises the Jews. We have in chapter 3, if you go to Esther chapter 3 and verse 1, it says, in those things King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, and Haman is an Agite. Now, when we talk about an Agite apparently is a descendant of Agag. You remember Agag, don't you? Remember Saul was to kill all the Amalekites and Agag? And he didn't. But he's a descendant of that. And so you could see there's a friction between the Jews and the Amalekites. Now, the king is not an Amalekite. He's not a defender of Judaism, but he's not an Amalekite. But Haman is an Amalekite. So Haman now is given a position of authority. And we find in chapter 3, turn with me if you will, to verses 5 through 6, that when Haman saw Mordecai did not bow down or pay him homage, Haman was filled with wrath. Verse 6, but he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai. See, Mordecai revealed in verse 4 that he was a Jew. And Mordecai, people of Mordecai, instead Haman sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, just say Jim, no, I don't, the people of Mordecai. So what happens as we look at this, and by the way, these are events that played out. This is not a story. These are actual events that played out. And verses 8 and 9, as Haman is given this huge power, he convinces the king, verses 8 and 9, he convinces the king, we need to destroy the Jews. That these are a people that have their own laws. They're not going to be good citizens of your kingdom. And not only does he convince him, he's offering to pay 10,000 talents to get the work done. In other words, hey, king, this is what's happening. You've got these Jews, and they're not good for this kingdom. And I'll involve the 10,000 talents to destroy him, to destroy them. And the king gives in. And the decree in 312 was written to be carried on the 13th day of the 12th month of Adar. And that would be between February and March, the month of Adar, if you look at a Jewish calendar there. So basically, on the first month, he gets the decree, and he sends the decree all over the land that we are going to destroy all the Jews on the 13th, on the 12th month, on the 13th day. And of course, when that happens, all the Jews are throughout the kingdom are overwhelmed. And we have recorded for us, as we continue to chapter 4, Esther's made aware of what Mordecai, because when Mordecai finds this out, he's in sackcloth and ashes. Now remember, him and Esther can't have personal communication right now. She's the queen. He's outside the gates. And he's in sackcloth. And when she finds out he's in sackcloth and ashes, she sends him some more garments. You can read that in verses 1 through 7. But he refuses to wear them. He refuses to put on those garments. He's overwhelmed by what's going to happen to the Jews. Now, here's my main point. When I think of the book of Esther, now, you might think of something else. But when I think of the book of Esther and my study of Esther in verses 13 and 14, here's the lesson to me. In verses 13 and 14, as he answers the queen, he states, "And Mordecai told them to answer Esther, 'Do not think in your heart that you will escape the king's palace any more than the other Jews. For if you remain completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place.'" I want to stop here. There was no doubt, not a shadow of a doubt, that Mordecai believed that the Jews were going to be annihilated, that there's going to be deliverance. Tells us that right there. Who knows, if not you, but you and your household fathers will perish. Yet who knows, and here's the point, yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this. She was an orphan girl raised by Mordecai. She's now the king's bride, the queen. She's now in a place of power. Haman, who's second in command, basically, is going to have the Jews destroyed. Who knows whether or not that you've come here for this very purpose? But he did tell her beforehand, but if you do nothing, you're going to die, and God will get deliverance from someone else. Now, he doesn't mention God's name, but we know who he's talking about, do we not? That God's going to get deliverance. And this helps me as I look at today. Things look terrible. Guess what, people? God is still in control. He's still in control today. Now, I have to appreciate the courage of Esther. And that's still in chapter 3. Because in chapter 4, verse 15 through 17, look at what it tells us. "And Esther told them a reply to Mordecai, 'Go gather all the Jews who are in the present in Shushan and fast for me and eat and drink 3 days and 3 nights, day or night. My maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish.'" Now, so she knows what's going on here, does she not? He wants Queen Esther to intervene. But the king hasn't called for her. And she just can go barge in. It's not America 2023. The only way she could go to the king is if he requested her. And if he didn't request her and she came in, she was subject putting herself to possible death. So what she says, okay, Mordecai says, who knows whether or not you've come to a time such as this? And she said, okay, I'll do that, but fast and pray for me 3 days. So she's going to want the prayers and fasting of the Jews in Shushan before she goes to the king. And we find, as you finish in chapter 4 and chapter 5, verse 1, it says, "Now it happened on the third day." Guess what? She goes to the king. Goes to the king. And she's granted, verses 1 through 5, she's granted to see the king. How much did prayer have involved? I think it had some involved, did it not? How much conviction did she have? Great deal of conviction. So she goes to the king. And then if we go later on, Haman comes into the picture. And chapter 5, verse 9. Verse 9, "So Haman went out that day joyfully because he was involved with Esther and the king. Now, Haman's thoroughly excited. He's been with Esther. He's been with the king. So he's been with the king and queen. And there's no one higher than him than those two. So in verses 9 and 10, chapter 5, verses 9 and 10, it says, so Haman went out that day joyfully with a glad heart. But when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he did not stand or tremble before him, he was filled with indignation against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and called for his friends and his wife. So Haman is so excited. He's taken in on the inner fold, king, queen, and Haman. And they're together. And he's going to go to a gathering with the king and queen. And he's telling this to his wife and how excited he was. And then chapter 5 and verse 14, he's so fed up with this Mordecai, he's having a gallows made for Mordecai. And it's not just a small gallows. It's high enough where everybody can see what's going on. And that's found in chapter 5 and verse 14. So right now, it's not looking too good for the children of Israel, for the Jews. And that takes us to chapter 6. Let's go to chapter 6. In chapter 6, beginning in verse 1, we have this. That night the king could not sleep. Now, let me ask you this, brethren, as we go back and read about this event. Chance or providence? That night the king couldn't sleep. Not only couldn't he sleep, but let's go on and read. So commanded to bring the book of records of the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. You remember back in chapter 2, when Mordecai found out those two eunuchs were going to kill the king? That was put in the book of records. King had never paid attention to it until now. And as this book of records is read, he finds out that there was nothing done favorably to Mordecai for what he's done. He basically saved the king's life. And it was recorded that he had sent somebody and saved the king's life. His name was in the records. And it's just amazing to me. Again, I don't believe this is chance. I don't believe it was just by chance he couldn't sleep that night. I don't believe it was just by chance that the book of records was brought to him. He could have done other things, but he's reading the book of records. But now he's concerned because nothing has been done for this man who basically, through him, his life was spared from those two eunuchs who were going to destroy him. So lo and behold, who's coming to the king but Haman? And he's going to request of Haman, what should be done to the man who did this for me, who spared my life? Well, Haman's so arrogant. Guess who Haman's thinking he's talking about? Himself! So let's read chapter 6, verses 6 through 10. So Haman came in, and the king asked him, what shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor? Now Haman thought in his heart, whom would the king delight to honor more than me? And Haman answered the king, said, for the man who the king delights to honor, let a royal robe be brought which the king has worn, and a horse on which the king has ridden, and which has a royal crest placed on its head. Then let this robe and the horse be delivered to the hand of the one who the king's most noble prince is, and that he may array the man whom the king delights to honor, then parade him on horseback throughout the city square, proclaiming before him, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king delights. Can you see Haman's mind right now? He said all this because guess who he's thinking is going to be dropped through the city? He is. I wish we could have had a visual of this. How do you think Haman reacted when he heard the name Mordecai? This is not a story. These are events that happened. Mordecai. And guess what? Haman was the noble selected to bring Mordecai. Now, what did Haman think about Mordecai? He hated him. He wanted to kill him. He had gallows made so he could be beheaded. And now what's he doing? Now, I don't know how much time transferred from chapter 2 to chapter 6. But it must have been devastating. He's still not in complete power, so he couldn't tell the king no. Because the king asked his advice. And so Haman had to bring Mordecai throughout the city, proclaiming how great Mordecai was. Not looking good. And chapter 12 through 14, chapter 6, verses 12 through 14. Afterwards, Mordecai went back to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house. Oh, I bet he hurried to his house, mourning with his head covered. And when Haman told his wife and all his friends everything that happened to him, his wise men and all his wife Zeres said to him, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail. Remember, who gave the order to kill the Jews? Haman. In other words, if he's Jew, and of course, he was of Jewish descent. So he's now on the downfall. As we continue on talking about this, we move on to chapter 7 and Esther's request. In chapter 7, and as Esther was in the presence of the king and also in the presence of Haman, she states in verses 3 through 6, Queen Esther answered and said, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given to me at my petition and my people at my request. For we have been sold by many people, and I to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss. So the king, Ahasuerus, answered and said to the queen Esther, who is he and where is he who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing? Guess what? Guess who's in the presence here? Haman. He's hearing all this. And Esther said, the adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman. So Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. Then the king arose in his wrath from the banquet of wine and went into the public garden. But Haman stood before Queen Esther, pleading for his life, and he saw that evil was determined against him by the king. How the tables have turned. Okay, what's the lesson? God is in control. Let me ask you something. In these six chapters, how many miracles were done? None. God can work by miracle if he so wanted to. He doesn't choose to do that today. But just because he doesn't work by miracle doesn't mean he's still not in control. Just like things maybe is God's will. We don't know. I can't say for sure, but we don't know. All I know is God's still in control. And we go on, and we find things continually get worse. 7 and 8. 7 and 8 of chapter 7. After 7, verse 8, when the king returned from the palace garden to the place of the banquet of wine, Haman had fallen across the couch where Esther was. And then the king said, will he also assault the queen while I am in the house? Not looking good for him. Not looking good at all. And remember the gallows that Haman had made for Mordecai? Guess who was the first one that got to use those gallows? Haman. He was put to death. Chapter 7. I tell you what, when I get discouraged, and I do get discouraged about this country the way it's going, and I don't know if God will spare this country. God hasn't given me any advance information. But I know as I stand here tonight, God is in control and that he cares about his children. And Haman was put to death. But it doesn't stop there. We find in chapter 8, verses 1 and 2, the ring that was on Haman's finger, the signet ring on his finger. Guess whose fingers it's on now? It's on Mordecai's finger. Isn't that something? And chapter 8, verses 11 through 12, the decree to kill all the Jews on the 12th month, on the month of Adar. is reversed. The Jews are not killed. That was totally reversed. However, in chapter 9, the destruction of the enemy of the Jews, including Haman's 10 sons, were what? Hung on the gallows. Big change of picture, is it not? Haman thought he was going to destroy the Jews. Ended up Haman and his family was destroyed by his evil choices. We also have, and here we come, chapter 9. You should be in Esther chapter 9. The Feast of Purim. In chapter 9, verses 21 through 23, we have recorded for us here in verse 21, to establish among them that they should celebrate yearly the 14th and 15th day of the month of Adar, so as those days which the Jews had rest from their enemies, as the month which was turned from sorrow to joy for them, for the mourning to a holiday, that they should make them a feasting and join, sending presents one to another and gifts to the four poor people. So there's the Purim. Let's go 26 and 27. And 26 and 27, it talks about, and they call these days Purim, after the name Pur. Therefore, because of the words of this letter, which they were seeing concerning this matter and what had happened to them, the Jews established and imposed it upon themselves from their descendants and all who would join them, that without fail they should celebrate these 2 days every year according to the writing of the instructions, according to the prescribed time. Now I have some additional information about Purim that's interesting, and this was taken from a dictionary. It talks about the Feast of Purim, and I only took a portion of it because we would have had 4 or 5 more charts had I put the whole thing. But in that statement, it's a springtime holiday of the Jewish. It falls on the 14th of Adar. Celebrates the defeat of Haman and the survival of the Jews in the book of Esther. The word Purim is a Hebrewized word meaning lots and is linked to the lots cast by Haman in order to decide what dates for his planned program against all Persian Jews. When these dates are celebrated, with the scroll of Esther being read in full every evening synagogue service, Purim encourages a carnival atmosphere with the children bringing noisemakers to the synagogue and the congregation, stamping their feet every time Haman's name is read in the scroll. That'd be interesting. They go back and look back. Now, guess who gets credit for them not being annihilated? God. Not mentioned there, but guess what? It's God. But what do we learn, people? If you don't learn anything else, what do we learn? We learn that God can work through you and I. God can work through you and I. Again, back to Esther 4 before we close this evening. And Mordecai told them to answer Esther. Do not think in your heart you will escape from the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. For if it remains completely silent at this time, relief and deliverance will arise. Don't forget that. Will arise for the Jews from another place. But you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time? What does God have plans for you? You can choose to do them or not do them. God's work will get done. Trust me, God does not need me in his kingdom. I am privileged that I can be a part of his kingdom. But what opportunities does God provide for me that I can elevate him day by day? And if I choose not to, God's will still get done, but without me. It's an exciting book. I'm not saying God has guided every minute of my day, but I do believe God puts opportunities out there, and we get to choose one of two ways to do it. Do we do it God's way or not? Because God's will get it done. God's kingdom will never be destroyed. And if you're in God's kingdom doing his will, who knows what you can do? Just think of this. A girl who lost her parents, who was raised by Mordecai, became queen and was instrumental in saving the Jews from annihilation. And I believe this was the hand of God. What about your life? What are you doing? What opportunities have God given for you? Are you using them? Are you looking for that opportunity to glorify him? Are you ignoring him? Or as some people are doing, and this scares me as Christians, some Christians are wringing their hands. Oh, what's going to happen? I don't know. But I'm a servant of God. I'm a servant of God. And I'm going to keep my eyes open to do whatever he would want me to do to bring glory to his kingdom. Could this nation be destroyed? Sure it could. But God's kingdom will never be destroyed. Don't forget God's providence and God's care for his people as we stand and as we sing.